The Drive with Robin Roz. Weekdays, 4 to 7, Jacaranda FM.
It is The Drive with Robin Roz, and we're very happy to be joined this afternoon by award-winning South African investigative journalist and court reporter Karen Morn is in studio. Hi.
Hello. I'm very enamored to be here. This is amazing, and I have big headphones on, and I feel really cool, so thank you for having me.
When was the last time you were in a radio studio with the mic?
Oh, it was ages ago. Like, I think it was in Power of Pop. Oh, I can't say that. Sorry. It was at one of your competitors. one of your competitors whose name shall not be mentioned, like Voldemort. But yes, it was super fun. But this is even better. I'm enjoying the vibe. Plus, there's glitter on the floor for exactly. Unknown reasons.
You never know Breakfast with Martin Bester what they are.
Yeah, you need to do an investigation immediately.
Karen is here because she's written a new book. It's called I Will Not Be Silenced. And the launch was last night. How was your book launch?
Oh, it was so amazing. Just the people that ended up coming. You know, like I have a lot of the people that were there, I had reported with or reported on. You know, there were people like Michelle LaRue, who obviously was the person that Dali and Paul Fu told to shut up. And journalists that I worked with from ENCA, some of my colleagues from News 24. And it was just like, you know, when you feel like your community is there for you. And I think I was quite apprehensive about it because I did get quite profound anxiety in the aftermath of what happened because of the level of threats we were receiving. And so I went from being like an insanely extroverted, like, yay, everybody kind of person, to just staying in my house the whole time. And this period of doing the book and coming, it's been like me coming a little bit back to that person who I thought, you know, I'd sort of said goodbye to. So it's kind of a beautiful, beautiful thing for me to feel like more like myself again.
So the kind of reclusive Karen that found herself in that period wasn't for no reason. There were obvious, very scary threats to your safety. How do you navigate that in terms of your mental health?
Well, so I'm a type 1 diabetic, right? So I have a pod on my arm and I inject myself whenever I eat. And when this was going on, when it got really bad, I started actually having like life-threatening comas. And the prologue for the book is about me waking up and I'm covered in sweat, and which is what happens when you start fitting. And I can see my mother's like pulled my pajama pants down to give me an injection in the thigh to get me out of the coma. And my dad is walking up and down the passage crying. And I remember just having this clear thought of like finding my way back to myself, like, because you feel very disorientated. And just being like, why, you know, like, how is this happening? And so even though as much as you will try and sort of say, well, I'm fine, I'm managing, your body is going to start showing those stresses. Because, you know, I remember having this, and I actually write about this in the book, because I think addressing mental health stuff is so important. Like, don't pretend that you're fine, because no one will be fine in this situation. And I remember like the clinical psychologist that I was seeing at one stage, she actually said to me, like, we were having this conversation and she said to me, are you finally ready to admit that this broke you? And I just looked at her and she said, but it would have broken anyone. And I just lost it. And when I realized, like, actually, you know what, like, why are you pretending? This has messed you up. You do need help. Get the help, get the care, ask, you know, find those people that you can be safe with. One of whom, of course, was Eusebius. And, you know, just keep going. But I think that it's very important. One of the things I really want people to take home from this is that, you know, it helps. Real strength exists in being able to say, you know what, I'm not coping. It's going on and literally, you know, when you're walking around with a broken heart, like with a, you know, it's you. No one expects you to do that. No one expects you to do that.
This is obviously part of an incredibly stressful time in your life. For someone listening and who doesn't know the work that you've done and why the stress came upon you, can you give us like the 2-minute bite-sized version of how you ended up here.
So essentially what happens is I started reporting on Jacob Zuma when I was about 26 years old. It was like my first big foray into legal journalism. I'd worked in the Cape High Court and like serial killers and, you know, the Sizzler's Game of Sarge Parlor Massacre, mm-hmm. Baby Jordan, all those big cases. But the political aspect was something that I wasn't really familiar with. Like I was more doing a lot of intimate femicides, those kind of things. Anyway, so I get assigned to Zuma's trial. I'm 26 years old. I'm very young in my newsroom to be on it. I look like a little brat doll. I've got like pink hair, pink streak, nose ring. And the editor was like, what? The news editor, Dave, was like, what the hell is this? I was like, just give me a chance. Anyway, so I started in the Zuma case, on the rape case. And I remember as this 26-year-old walking out, and I write about it, and seeing, you know, people holding a coffin that they wanted to put Kwesi inside. And, you know, they would scream, burn bitch, burn prostitute, like all kinds of names at her. And I remember as this young reporter just being kind of horrified by what happened. And then, of course, watching her being called Lucifer, watching her being called a spy, and then moving on in my career to reporting on all Jacob Zuma's other cases and watching as this campaign of silencing was launched against everyone from his estranged wife, Ma and Tuli, who was falsely accused of poisoning him and spent 5 years of her life in this kind of forced exile, to Tuli Madonsela, who got called all kinds of names just for doing her job, to, you know, Sissy Kampepe, who jails the former president and gets called emotional by him, which is a word that would never have been used against a male judge. Mm. And then Janet Love with the last elections and just the same word, same, you know, accusations. And then, of course, reporting on this and then it gets turned on you. Because he, the former president, was unhappy. He believed that myself and Billy Downer had been involved in violations of the NPA Act because another advocate had shared court papers with me, which are publicly available, including a sick note from one of his doctors. And he and his legal team transmogrify this into the NPA has given her our confidential medical records. Of course, what exactly I disclosed, no one knows because no one knows what his medical condition is. And they then say, he argues that I should be jailed for 15 years and he launches a private prosecution against me and Downer. And of course, as this is happening, there's this massive kind of orchestrated social media campaign that's just like the modern day version of burn the bitch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can't imagine. I was reading it and I know the story and I've been following it and so on. Mm-hmm. And you know, you sort of think to yourself, oh, well, this is a nonsense case. It's obviously going to get thrown out at some point. There's the backlash that comes with it on social media and so on, we'll talk about. But it didn't occur to me that in the back of your mind must be this very real idea of the president, the former president of a country, mm-hmm. wants to throw me in prison for more than a decade. Like, that's a terrifying thought.
The weird thing was, and one of the comforting things with reporting on Jacob Zuma for all this time was like, I know that guy's playbook. So when this stuff started, I said to my boss, I said, I can see which way this wind is blowing. And everyone said to me, there's no way, that's insane. And I was like, we'll just wait and see. And of course, you know, you have the horrible thing of being right. But I have absolute faith in constitutional democracy. Like, I really believe in the courts. And, you know, I thought maybe, you know, there might be an adverse court ruling against us and we would appeal. But I knew that my company was behind me. And I also knew that I had literally the best lawyers in the country, like, fighting the case for me. And to quote the great Reedy Tlhabi, I also knew that we were right. Mm. You know, and that is kind of an energy in itself. We weren't lying. We weren't, everything that they said about us was not true. It wasn't legally sound. And, you know, I've last week I was in Berlin with journalists from around the world, journalists in countries where they are oppressed, where people, you know, one of the women there was jailed for 47 days in Nicaragua because she's a journalist and she went and took food to activists who were protesting. I mean, bizarre. And then you like, you know, Myanmar, where someone's been forced to move to Thailand because they have no free press there. Romania, like Mexico, 170 journalists murdered, you know, insane stuff. And so, you know, it was a really awful thing, but we do exist in a democracy. And for me, it's just reinforced this absolute certainty that we have to keep fighting for it, because the kind of scenario that people like Jacob Zuma want is one where journalists can get jailed because you on the wrong side of their particular, you know, viewpoint. And we must resist that, because once we lose a free media, once we lose a judiciary, once we lose an active civil society, our democracy is real jeopardy.
So in the writing of I Will Not Be Silenced, did you feel like you were almost re-traumatizing yourself, because you've got to like remember in such fine detail every moment of everything that happened to you? So why?
It's like, it's weirdly cathartic, because I mean, there's this great line, if you want to have revenge on someone, describe them. And so for me, like writing about some of the legal shenanigans that happened with, you know, everyone's favorite advocate, like rewatching those things, because I was kind of shell-shocked when it was happening. I was doing like trauma release exercises with my legs and they were just tremoring the whole time. So I didn't really know what was going on. And like I was talking about at the launch yesterday, Billy and I, when we were in the dock the first time, started singing Teddy Bear's Picnic as like stress relief. Because you can't be like really scared when you're sending, you know, because I was like, picnic time for teddy bears. And like, when he's like, the little teddy bears. So like, you know, I mean, I know it sounds bizarre, but it really did help. And yeah, I mean, there were, you know, I remember the moment when Carl Niehaus and Mzwanele Mani started filming us, like, and Billy was like, he kept saying to me, I'm so sorry, we shouldn't have gone to sit in the dock early, this is my fault. And I was like, it's nonsense, there's no one to blame here, it's not our fault, it's okay. And yeah, I have a very big bond with him now. And I will still report objectively on the NPA. But like just that experience, reliving it, like finding the humor in it, I think was important. But there are some things that were like, I just cried the whole time I wrote about it, was Eusebius's memorial. And I think the hardest thing for me is like, oh, I don't want to cry in this interview. The hardest thing for me is that I didn't get to grieve my friend. Because I was at his memorial with an ear infection and we got the notification that the judgment was coming out the next day. And he had supported me through it and then obviously died so tragically of an epileptic fit. But I was so overwhelmed with grief with him, but in the back of my mind was this judgment. This judgment is coming out, you know, tomorrow. And you know, people often say to me, oh, will you sue them? And I'm like, no, like the stuff they took from me, I can't get back. It's not anything I could get back.
Social media has changed the way we interact with each other and with stories and with the news and so on as it breaks. And it gives voice to this gigantic, faceless, relentless mob of people who can bay for your blood and call for your head all day, every day without break. And I can't imagine what it's like to go through that. And I can't imagine how you talked about your therapist saying, have you finally admitted that this broke you? But it would have broken anyone. Almost receiving that permission to feel all the things that come with that level of toxicity and vitriol.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a hard thing because I think, you know, on some level, you want to be like, screw these guys. Like, they're not going to, like, take me. They're not going to take my joy. They're not going to take away me away from me. But they do. And that's why I always say to people, I mean, I'm on social media, so all of us are, because it's part of our jobs and whatever. But I'm always like, don't take it too seriously. Mm-hmm. Don't let it get into your psyche. Don't let it get into your sense of yourself and your community. Because there is ample, ample data, increasing levels of data, whether it's in South Africa, all over the world, that shows that so much of what happens there is manipulated. It's not real life. Like, I mean, if I were to believe social media, I would walk out of here and someone would literally stab me in the lung immediately, because it's like, or, you know, unfortunately, the rape, sexual violence threats, which are commonplace against women, especially female journalists. But that isn't what happened. I had one incident where an Uber driver asked me, why does everyone hate you? And I was like, no, and, you know, do they really? And I prepared, like, you know, like,
I'm just trying to go to dinner,
I'm just
dude.
A friendly guy, you know.
Who have you been talking to?
But that was, like, the only incident. Like, the vast majority of incidents, and that's why I freaking love this country, it's like people walking up to you in the street and high-fiving you and your parents. Like, and I was at the sushi bar, and this dad's there with his little kid, and he's like, son, this woman is a badass hero. And I'm like, hey, I will enjoy my salmon roses. And then, you know, people like walking up to me in the street and hugging me and just saying, don't give up. Like, that's the heart of this country. So I know for a fact, from my own real experience, that once I got out of that place of like overwhelm and fear and started engaging with people, that what I was seeing on social media was actually not a reflection of like the heart and soul of this incredible country, you know? But I actually, like, the next book I'm working on is about social media, and I'm arguing that we need to fundamentally reconsider its value in our lives, because it's actually disrupted our notion of shared truth and understanding. And I think when we analyze the results of the American elections, the role that social media played in that, and the outcome that was achieved there is going to be momentous. Mm. One last point on this. When FD did a study on pro-Kremlin infiltration on social media in South Africa, in Africa, the two biggest countries, the countries that had the most influence was South Africa and Nigeria. So we are in a manipulated environment, and we have to be aware of that. Don't take it too seriously.
Yeah. Karen, I want to talk a bit about your family. Your family has always been so important to you. I've known you. We went to the same high school. Yes. I was in the same class as Karen's sister.
Loves you.
I know. I love her too. I know that family bond is very, very strong. What kind of impact did this have on them? Because I'm just thinking, as a mom, I would have just taken my child and gone, no, I must protect you. I don't want this to happen to you.
It's been very interesting because, like, my mother, we have a very interesting introvert dimension in the family. Guess who's the extrovert? Me and my mother are, like, very emotional, very expressive. Blah, blah, blah. And my sister and my dad are very much introverted, and my brother's more of a social extrovert. But despite that, and despite the fact that, you know, I think it has taken a massive toll on them, they never ever told me stop. Like, they never said to me, don't do this. And I think that my whole family's always had the sense of, like, my dad always said to us, the only thing you have in your life is your name. And once you lose it, you'll never get it back. So we grew up with this thing about, you tell the truth. And we also grew up with this thing of, you're not a coward. You don't step away from a fight. And you know my sister. My sister's a quiet person. But if you come and start nonsense, my sister will, she'll deal with you in a very quiet but meaningful way.
Yes.
With a death stare that will, like, literally skin you alive. So, you know, like, we weren't brought up to be scared. And I think that, you know, they worry about me. They've, like, I think it's caused, but they would never ever say to me, don't do it, because all of them in their own way are committed to this country and making it better.
The book obviously tells your story of where you started and where you ended up and the journey that it's taken to get you there. And you've touched on a bunch of characters, savory and unsavory, in South African popular you know, political landscape. Yes. What message do you want people to take away from the book?
I think it's just that thing of, I mean, to put it plainly, we are all going to die. And there's this amazing quote from Julius Caesar where he says, "A coward dies many times before his death, but the valiant taste of death but once." And there's nothing that you can do to prolong the end of your existence, but you can transform the way that you live and you can make a difference. So be one of those people that supports independent media, supports civil society. When people send you nonsense, like social media posts that are clearly not true, call them out about it. Set a standard of truth in your own life. Don't be that person that just, you know, grabs onto stuff that reinforces your biases. Think about other people's perspectives. And, you know, and also, you know, you don't have to be like a big hero, but you can be a standard bearer for truth within your own relationships and to speak up when things are wrong. And I mean, the state of the world, we know what's going on. We know what people are facing, what people, their terrible oppression. And we all of us have voices. So use your voice because it can change things and it will.
Wow. What a beautiful note to end on. I want to just say, and just double check something.
Yes.
Your brother obviously was the cutie at the boys' school next door. And everyone was like, ooh, Paul, ooh, ooh. Did he go to a matric dance after a rugby match?
And it his is whole correct. Yes, that is correct. Paul's face was, he got someone put a boot in his face. Yes. And it got split down the side and it was all bloody. And he went, I think it was his matric, he went to a matric dance, yes, with this wounded face. And also, you know, the thing is, my brother is a pastor.
Yes.
And that man, last time when we did the nuclear launch, rocked up in the front and heckled his sister. And I was like, what kind of pastor are you? And Adrian Besson was like, I like that guy.
Oh, it's been such a pleasure hanging out. I Will Not Be Silenced is the new book by Karen Morn. Where can we get it?
It's at Exclusives. It's also on Amazon. It's on Kindle. Please read it. Let me know what you think.
There you go. If you're looking for a big holiday, read around the pool or on the beach over the festive season, this will be the one. Karen, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, guys. It was so, that was genuinely a cool experience for me.